It is Friday, April the 13th. This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us today. Coming up, Trump tweets about potential strike on Syria over alleged chemical attack.
This could be that the president is trying to keep the Syrian government guessing when the attack will take place and how it will occur.
Beijing being tough about U.S.-China trade tensions.
China has to appear strong in the face of Donald Trump, otherwise it feels it would end up giving too much away in negotiations.
We'll have the latest on the U.S.-Russia probe, but also what's happening in the life of singer-songwriter Mariah Carey. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. We begin with Russia. At the United Nations, its ambassador has urged the United States and its allies to avoid a military strike on Syria, saying the goal is to avert war. We get more now on the story from VOA's Margaret Bashir at the UN in New York.
Security Council members met privately to discuss the escalating rhetoric and threats of military reprisals after the United States, Britain, and France blamed Syrian President Bashar al-Assad's forces for a suspected chlorine gas attack April 7th on the rebel enclave of Douma in eastern Ghouta. The attack killed at least 40 people and sickened hundreds more. Damascus has denied using chemical weapons. Russian envoy Vasily Nebenzia told reporters after Thursday's meeting that aggressive policies and preparations by the three countries are a violation of the UN Charter and a threat to international peace and security.
The immediate priority is to avert the danger of war.
He was asked if he meant a war between Russia and the United States.
We cannot exclude any possibilities, unfortunately, because we saw messages that are coming from Washington. They were very bellicose.
Nebenzia said Moscow is very concerned with the dangerous escalation in Syria.
Hope that there will be no point of no return, that the U.S. And the allies will refrain from military action against a sovereign state.
Russia's military is present in Syria, where it is supporting the Assad government. President Donald Trump has said a U.S. response to the alleged chemical attack would come fairly soon. On Wednesday, he warned that missiles will be coming to Syria. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, the United Nations.
President Trump also has been tweeting a great deal about all of this. We asked Richard Bides, a senior fellow and director of the Center for Political and Military Analysis at the Hudson Institute, about the potentiality of a retaliatory strike by the U.S. He said in light of the frequent tweets by President Trump, there could be two good things at work.
This could be that the president is trying to keep the Syrian government guessing when the attack will take place and how it will occur. There was some concern, and based on his earlier tweets, that he was telling the Syrians we would use his missiles and so on. But this, his latest tweets make it less clear when the U.S. might attack and how it might do so. And the second good indication is that the president and his national security staff are reviewing options in detail. There's not a rush response. They're taking their time to figure out what kind of attack to undertake, or how long, how many systems, and so on. Or perhaps not use military force at all, perhaps work with sanctions, diplomacy, or other means. There may be a third process at work, which is probably perhaps less helpful, in that the problem with the tweets are that it reflects a spontaneous thinking of the president, and we sometimes, as outside observers, focus on them too much. And what we really should be focusing on is the national security decision-making process. And so it's our fault for taking these tweets too seriously.
On the morning of April the 7th, 2017, the U.S. launched a retaliatory strike into Syria. It involved 19 Tomahawk cruise missiles. That strike, authorized by President Trump, was said to be in response to a chemical attack that occurred on April the 4th. Before that strike, the U.S. coordinated with its allies in Europe and in the Middle East. But this time around, it appears coordination with allies is not part of the process. We ask Hudson Institute scholar Richard Weitz for his thoughts.
I know that they've taken care, unlike the last time, to engage heavily with allies, particularly the British and French, and they may be trying to discuss if they want to harmonize the policy so that if the U.S. does something and doesn't want to be criticized with its allies, that's a minimum level of cooperation. If perhaps they want more extensive cooperation so that the allies would participate in whatever the U.S. does, and therefore you have to coordinate the strikes since the allies have different packages, different capabilities than the U.S. in some ways. You'd have to figure out, well, maybe the French and the British will attack this target and the U.S. will attack this other target, which is maybe more heavily defended, or, you know, decide how, reach some kind of agreement about how to warn the Russians or whether to, you know, who would take charge of that attack to try and minimize that. Or, as you suggested, perhaps the Allies are pressing not for an attack, for some other means, and so the administration is trying to sort that out. And, of course, we have a recent major turnover in the U.S. national security community, and you've got new people coming in, and you've got old people leaving, and so that might be disrupting the process as people, the new people come in, naturally want to review the information and the options before they sign on to something that the old people were recommending, the departing people.
Richard Weitz is a senior fellow, and he's also director of the Center for Political Military Analysis at the Hudson Institute. A Chinese Commerce Ministry spokesperson has warned Beijing will fight if the U.S. escalates trade tensions. Gao Feng said that China's resolution and confidence in firmly safeguarding the interest of the country and its people will not be changing. He said China is prepared to fight back steadfastly. Referring to remarks earlier this week by Chinese President Xi Jinping, who promised to open up his country's economy, Gao Feng said it is completely misleading to see that a concession, any concession to the U.S., he said it reflects the country's current development level and has nothing to do with the economic and trade frictions with Washington. Shane Oliver, a chief economist and strategist at the Sydney-based AMP Capital, tells my colleague Victor Beattie this appears to be a case of China playing good cop, bad cop, and as part of its negotiating strategy with the Trump administration.
China has to appear strong in the face of Donald Trump, otherwise it's going to end up, it feels it would end up giving too much away in negotiations. So that's why you're hearing comments from the Commerce Department, for example. And of course, a few weeks ago, the last few weeks, the Chinese ambassador to Washington has said exactly the same thing, that China will retaliate in proportion to whatever the US does or announces. But by the same token, the Chinese leadership, I think, is quite clearly aware of the issue, that it does need to continue to open things up, not just to appease President Trump, but more importantly, I think, to see the ongoing development of the Chinese economy. And of course, that's what President Xi reiterated earlier this week. So I think, yes, we are seeing what appears to be disparate messages, but I think it's a classic case of good cop, bad cop. I think ultimately China is open to negotiation with the U.S. on this issue, and I think ultimately that's the way it's going to be resolved.
The Commerce Ministry spokesman said that Mr. Xi was merely outlining China's strategy to open up further and had nothing to do with trade frictions with Washington.
China has been opening up over many, many years, but I think there's no doubt that the Chinese leadership would nevertheless be aware of the issues with the U.S. And, of course, it is noteworthy that President Xi's comments did make reference to intellectual property, as did Premier Li's comments a few weeks ago, particularly pledging to respect intellectual property. And that, of course, I think is a clear reference to some of the gripes that President Trump has in relation to China. I don't think they would have made that reference were it not for the Americans mentioning this issue. But I do think, you know, we're going to hear this ongoing, that sort of stuff going on. But I think at the end of the day, the Chinese are open to negotiation on these issues. I think ultimately that's the way it will go. But yes, this sort of sniping will continue. And quite clearly, we still have a way to go before these negotiations actually happen. I don't think they're happening at the moment. and before we get a result.
President Trump tweeted on Monday that China's maintaining 25% import tariffs on U.S. auto exports compared to the U.S. 2.5% duties on Chinese automobiles. The Commerce Ministry spokesman said Thursday it's not reasonable to require tariffs to be completely equal for both sides.
Well, that I think is part of the agreement that underpins the World Trade Organization, that less developed countries, and China is still a lowly developed economy compared to the US, that they're able to maintain higher tariffs than developed countries do. And so it is quite common to have that disparate level of tariffs in place. And China would probably say, well, yeah, we're still being consistent with the World Trade Organization rules. And you'd probably find that many emerging countries like China have similar higher tariffs on U.S. goods than the U.S. would have on goods from those countries.
Shane Oliver is a chief economist and strategist at the Sydney-based AMP Capital, and he was speaking with VOA's Victor Beattie. This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter, every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America. Savor the flavor of African music. I'm Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Tune in, feast your ears, and dig in to an hour of amazing Pan-African music, featured interviews, and music news. Music Time in Africa, Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
This is VOA's International Edition. President Trump has decried the never-ending and corrupt, his words, investigation into links between the 2016 campaign for president, the one that he conducted, and Russia, which he acknowledged is taking tremendous time and focus for him. In one of a string of Twitter comments, Mr. Trump this week assailed Monday's FBI raid on the New York office and hotel resident of his personal attorney, Michael Cohen. We get more now from VOA national correspondent Jim Malone.
At the White House, President Trump declined to say anything further about the FBI raid targeting his personal lawyer, Michael Cohen. But the president did not hold back on Twitter, once again blasting the Russia probe as a witch hunt. White House spokeswoman Sarah Huckabee Sanders was asked about the status of Special Counsel Robert Mueller's future.
Do you believe he has the power to fire Special Counsel Robert Mueller? Does he believe that's within his power?
Certainly believes he has the power to do so.
Official Washington was still trying to digest Trump's lengthy attack against Mueller the previous day.
Why don't I just fire Mueller? Well, I think it's a disgrace what's going on. We'll see what happens. But I think it's really a sad situation when you look at what happened. And many people have said you should fire him. Again, they found nothing.
Democrats immediately warned the president not to go after Mueller, including Senate leader Chuck Schumer.
President Trump said the raid was a disgrace. I say to the president, Mr. President, you have it wrong. Interfering with the investigation would be a disgrace. Calling it attack on our country is a disgrace. What matters is the rule of law. In this country, no man is above the law, not even the president.
Republicans were more cautious, including Senator Tom Tillis of North Carolina.
I think thematically he said similar things before, so I don't think that that's anything new in my opinion.
FBI agents seized financial documents and other records from Cohen Monday in connection with payments to adult film actress Stormy Daniels and Playboy model Karen McDougal. Daniels claims to have had a brief affair with Trump back in 2006, which the president denies. Justice Department approval for the raid on Cohen's office and hotel is significant, says American University analyst Chris Edelson.
you have to show them that you have probable cause to believe that a crime was committed, and that the evidence you're looking to collect relates to that crime.
Prosecutors apparently wanted to act quickly, says Eric Tucker.
But what it means is generally that there is concern that the person whose home or office is being searched might destroy evidence or conceal documents that the government wants.
Trump would likely face additional legal and political consequences if he did fire Mueller, says Chris Edelson.
If Donald Trump fires Mueller or Sessions or Rosenstein or all of them, that could create the basis for additional legal problems for him, or additional obstruction of justice concerns. So he's in a really bad space here.
A new Quinnipiac University poll released Tuesday found nearly 7 in 10 Americans believe the president should not fire Mueller, including 55% of Republicans surveyed. Jim Malone, VOA News, Washington.
President Trump's nominee for Secretary of State, current CIA Director Mike Pompeo, faced intense questioning about the ongoing Russia probe, his relationship with the president, and hot spots around the globe during his confirmation hearing before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Pompeo indicated he would not resign in protest if Mr. Trump fired Special Counsel Robert Mueller, who is, as we've heard, leading the investigation of ties between Russia and Mr. Trump's inner circle.
My instincts tell me that my obligation to continue to serve as America's senior diplomat will be more important at increased times of political domestic turmoil. We've seen this in America before, right? This wouldn't be the first time that there's been enormous political turmoil. My recollection of the history is that previous secretaries of state stayed the course, continued to do their work, continued to do the requirements, statutory and constitutional, that they had. Having not given it a great deal of thought, I'm confident that that's the path that I would take.
Senators of both political parties stress the need for a Secretary of State who can navigate the often stormy White House and stand up to the president when needed. Pompeo was chosen by President Trump to replace Rex Tillerson as Secretary of State after Mr. Trump fired Tillerson a few weeks ago. Now we're moving on to VOA's Doug Bernard, joining us now with what's trending on social media. What you got, Doug?
Well, amid all the grim news that we seem to be getting this week, today in Israel, at least, is a day called Holocaust Remembrance Day. This is a day, not a holiday at all, obviously, but really a day of commemoration that's marked in Israel. I think it's the only country that officially marks it, but many people around the world, obviously, are thinking about it, talking about it on social media, and sharing their thoughts. And some of the thoughts we'll get to in a quick moment. Some of these, a little disturbing. The Department of State, U.S. Department of State, tweeted out today, "When we take a stand against intolerance and demand respect and inherent dignity and human rights for every person, we give renewed meaning to never again." The Israeli Foreign Ministry sent this out. "On this Holocaust Remembrance Day, we commemorate the 6 million Jews who were murdered in the Holocaust and remember 36 righteous diplomats from 21 countries who risked their lives to save thousands of Jews during World War II. Jerry Dunleavy has this to send out in honor of Holocaust Remembrance Day. Here are some beautiful quotes from Anne Frank. He shares several of them. Here's just one. "How wonderful it is that nobody need wait a single moment before starting to improve the world." Of course, Anne Frank, who famously was hidden in Amsterdam, later found by the Nazis and died in the Holocaust. Here's a quote someone sent out from Elie Wiesel. "There may be times when we are powerless to prevent injustice, but there must never be a time when we fail to protest." And Michael Dixon has this sad fact. He says, "The global Jewish population, though growing, has still not reached the level it was before the Holocaust." That's I did not know that. I'm assuming that there is some factual basis to that. I'd have to look it up, but it's just a shocking thought all the same. Here's another shocking thought, also in link with this day. There's a new poll that was released, a poll of about 1,300 U.S. citizens, adults, about the Holocaust. Check this out. 11% of U.S. adults say they have never heard about the Holocaust, which is unbelievable. And even more shocking, 41% couldn't tell you what Auschwitz is or was. So really, I think some kind of chilling thoughts there at the end. But again, lots of people sharing, you know, powerful thoughts, quotes, and images on this Holocaust Remembrance Day.
Many thanks to you, Doug. That is VOA's Doug Bernard, and this is VOA.
This is BizBeat.
The price of fizz has gone up because the government of Scotland is taxing the sugar inside these drinks because 60% of the country is obese or overweight. Deborah Shipton is with NHS Health Scotland.
We're hoping it would have two impacts. One, that there will be reformulation, so there will be less sugar added to drinks. But also, we know that price matters, and it will start to redress the fact that we have a lot of cheap, sugary food around.
Companies don't have to do this. Coca-Cola says it won't change its formula, so that means an extra cost to buy a can of Coke. But half the drink makers selling their products in the country have cut down the sugar content in their drinks already, including Scotland's top-selling Iron Brew, prompting some people to become collectors of the old sugary version. The sugar tax revenue will go to healthy school meals and to school sports. From VOA's BizBeat, I'm Philip Alexio.
This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us today. You know, with a long string of hits and appearances, fans of Mariah Carey may feel they know the pop superstar very well, but throughout her long career, Carey has been keeping a secret. VOA's Top 20 Countdown host Ray McDonald reveals the secret to VOA's Jim Stevenson and what she's been dealing with and how she's moving forward.
Now we are not afraid, although we know there's much to fear. We were moving mountains long before we knew we could.
Mariah Carey has been in the news for some time, not so much for her music, but for her life. I mean, her life has been a little frantic for, you know, much of the 21st century.
Yes.
Going back to her 2001 breakdown. And now we know the reason behind that, because she has come forward about her long-running battle with bipolar disorder. She's the cover story this week in People magazine. Mariah says she was first diagnosed in 2001, despite being hospitalized after suffering a physical and emotional breakdown. She refused to believe the diagnosis. And she says she recently sought treatment after going through a terrible couple of years. It was highlighted by a highly public romantic breakup with Australian tycoon James Packer. And people might also remember her 2016 New Year's Eve performance, which was pretty awful and
yes,
marred by technical glitches, and it was a bad look for Mariah. All this time, while she was trying to deny her bipolar disorder, Mariah says she lived with a constant fear that someone would expose her. She's now in therapy. She's taking medication for bipolar 2 disorder. Now, this involves periods of depression and hypomania, which can cause irritability, sleeplessness, and hyperactivity. She is working on an album. It's due out later this year, and Mariah Carey says she came forward now to remove the stigma surrounding mental health issues and to let fellow sufferers know they're not alone. She joins artists like Demi Lovato in trying to destigmatize mental illness. I applaud her for that.
Absolutely. Obviously, a condition through no fault of her own. And it's so difficult when you're in the limelight like that. Mm-hmm. Everything, every little minute detail is exposed, it seems, and examined. And for battling a condition like that, that has to be awfully difficult. It just must have compounded it for her.
Absolutely. Mariah Carey lives in a media fishbowl. She's been a larger-than-life superstar for, 25 years? Mm-hmm. At least. So, it must have been terribly difficult for her. And, she's raising 2 6-year-olds, and she just wants to get her life back on track.
The flip side is that she can use her fame and her stature to talk about this.
Which is
and
exactly
to help
what
people.
She's doing, yes.
And that's wonderful.
If you want to read the Complete People article, we have it posted on our VOA1 Facebook page, VOA1 The Hits.
And check out Ray each and every week. He's our Top 20 Countdown host.
Thank you, Jim.
Thanks, Ray.
Very, very good. One last story for you today. A man from the U.S. state of Connecticut has pleaded guilty. What for? Well, hacking into the iCloud accounts of Hollywood stars and others so he could steal personal information. Nothing new, I guess, but anyway, here's the story. This also includes private photographs and videos of these people. Federal prosecutors here in the United States say that 26-year-old George Garofano pleaded guilty to unauthorized access to a protected computer to obtain all of this information. The charge stemmed from the investigation into the 2014 scandal in which the private photos of Jennifer Lawrence, actress Kirsten Dunst, Kate Upton, others were made public. Prosecutors say that Garofano sent emails that appeared to be from Apple encouraging victims to disclose their usernames and their passwords. He then used that information to illegally access nearly 250 iCloud accounts. The guy remains on a $50,000 bond. He's out of jail but faces up to 5 years in prison at sentencing. That date has yet been determined. Well, thanks very much for joining us here on the Voice of America for International Edition. It's always good to have you here. Latest world news is straight ahead. Hope you'll stay tuned. For our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Dave Magnus, I'm Steve Norman. We're all in Washington hoping you have a super Friday.
Next, an international public service announcement by the United States government.
The U.S. Department of State's Rewards for Justice program is offering a reward of up to $10 million for information leading to the identification or location of Muhammad al-Jawlani, leader of the Al-Nusra Front, or ANF, terrorist group. This is the first Rewards for Justice reward offer for a leader of al-Nusra Front, the Syrian branch of al-Qaeda. In 2013, al-Jawlani pledged allegiance to al-Qaeda and its leader, Ayman al-Zawahiri, after he had a public falling out with ISIS. In 2016, in a video posted online, al-Jawlani praised al-Qaeda and al-Zawahiri and claimed the ANF was changing its name to Jabhat Fath al-Sham. Under al-Jawlani's leadership, ANF has carried out multiple terrorist attacks throughout Syria, often targeting civilians. In April 2015, ANF reportedly kidnapped and later released approximately 300 Kurdish civilians from a checkpoint in Syria. In June 2015, ANF claimed responsibility for the massacre of 20 residents in a Druze village in Idlib province, Syria. In January 2017, ANF merged with several other hardline opposition groups to form Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, or HTS. ANF remains al-Qaeda's affiliate in Syria, and Jawlani remains the leader of ANF, which is at the core of HTS. In 2014, ANF was designated as a foreign terrorist organization by the State Department. The same year, the UN added ANF to its sanctions list. Since its inception in 1984, the Rewards for Justice program has paid in excess of $125 million to more than 80 people who provided actionable information that helped bring terrorists to justice or prevented acts of international terrorism worldwide. For more information about al-Jawlani, go to www.rewardsforjustice.net. We encourage anyone with information about al-Jawlani to contact the Rewards for Justice office via email on the website, info@rewardsforjustice.net, by phone 1-800-877-3927 in North America, or by mail, Rewards for Justice, Washington, D.C., 20520, 1-800-333-USA. All information will be kept strictly confidential.
That was an international public service announcement by the United States government.
Thank you.